Okay, I'm John Nicol. I have recently taken early retirement from a position as a Professor of Innovation and Enterprise at the University of Plymouth. The history education area aspect of my work has been a sort of base interest for the last 5 or 6 years, but has not been the central feature in what I do. Before that, I was a PGC secondary tutor at the University of Exeter, and all my work revolved and related to that. We can talk about that in relation to question one.
Yes. Can you briefly sketch out your career in history education?
Yeah. One of the arguments I put forward about the development of history education in this country, and I'm going to use the term history education because I think it is a good one, is that from the late 60s, it had a relationship to the expansion of the universities in the context of a host of young, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed research students doing PhDs or master's degrees or research degrees in general, who were then unable to get employment in the university sector following the staffing of those universities during that great period of expansion of what are known as the plate glass stroke red brick universities, and a significant number of them went into teaching as not a preferred option, but as something which they had to do for a variety of reasons. And I can think of several of that generation, Bernard Barker, myself, John Fiennes, slightly earlier, who would fall into that category.
We're talking about the late 50s?
But no, talking about the late 60s. Into the early 70s. And this is really quite important because it does have a seminal influence. And you had a group of young men and women coming into history education who were academic historians. And that means that they had a very clear and full grasp upon the nature of this discipline within the context in which they were doing their doctoral stroke master's research. And that has had a lasting and penetrating influence, particularly upon the skills and processes dimension of what has been going on.
So can I ask you, did you leave university and then go straight into teaching? Or did you do a PhD there?
Well, I did a doctorate at Cambridge, or did the research, and then ran out of money and ended up either, as I say, I could have been a cynic or a sceptic, and I took the sceptical route, and instead of working for the Conservative Party's research department, I went into teacher training. And we won't talk about my politics, which are quite interesting but confused. So I did the, as I said, in inference, I did the academic stuff in terms of doing a doctorate with Eric Stokes at Cambridge. It was a great privilege and a delight.
What years was that, John?
Oh, this would be 67 through to 70. 67 through to, yeah, about 70-ish. And then I trundled off because of, what I, as I said, into teacher training. And one of the issues that there is that the influence of that affected the way in which I approached the teaching of history. Remember, at this point in time, they were just beginning to think about the ideas of Sylvester and Schools Council History Project, grounded in Collingwood's thinking. And they were also beginning to think about sort of more creative approaches. And there was a natural relationship between my PhD, in which I had again the privilege of sitting next door to a man called Kirti Chowdhury, who created, or was Britain's earliest and perhaps greatest econometric historian, who was interested in the modelling of the East India Company as a commercial enterprise on the same kind of scale in its time as Unilever or Shell or whatever. And the East India Company was operating effectively in the mid-18th century, and he sat at one table doing his work on the East India Company. I sat at my desk doing my work upon the East India Company in the context of the conquest of Bengal with Clive of India. As I say to people who says, what is your academic expertise? I say quite happily, I'm the world's leading expert on Bengal politics in the 1750s, which is translated into the Black Hole of Calcutta, the conquest of Bengal, Clive of India, and all that. But the serious point about that is that Kirti was fully engaged in producing analytical models which were related to the computing of the economic data. And on the basis of that, when I went into initial teacher training and came across another major influence upon my thinking in terms early thinking on history teaching, I came across the new geography where they had developed through a man called Rex Walford games and simulations which were based upon models of geographical situations, i.e. the abstraction of the key features and then making them dynamic through the simulation mode of operating. And so it was very logical to put Kirti Chowdhury's East India Company and gaming and simulation in geography together, and I came up and wrote on my teaching practice a simulation called Trade and Discovery, which was the first, to my knowledge, dedicated, developed history game and simulation. and that was contemporary with those, which Bernard Barker was developing with a friend whose name I've forgotten now. So there was this relationship between the academic and the teacher training, and the development of a form of teaching which was dynamic, interactive, engaging, intellectually rewarding, at least for me, if not for the kids.
So you started teaching in 1971?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Where were you teaching first?
Oh, vaguely. I went back, well, we started off in Birmingham, obviously, and I went to Birmingham to train in Birmingham schools, and I went to a small grammar school in Shrewsbury and stayed there for a few years, back 2 or 3 years, and then trundled off down to the Institute, not the Institute of Education. I had a year's fellowship at the School of Oriental and African Studies, working upon textbook development. That was very kind of them, very nice, and had a very nice year. Mm. I wrote the first lot of textbooks I produced.
And then you went down to Exeter then?
Yes, and that was in 79. So had an interesting and varied early career. But when you said back to career in history education, we go back to the development from the teacher training phase. And then on the basis of that, I went and worked for 3 years in a school called Repton and met a man called David Burt, who was very able, very interested in publishing. And one of the things I've always done is I've tended to work with people for whatever reason. And I've always found that a catalytic idea, is that a combination of two people in some ways is better than, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And David and I worked together, and we had been contacted by Blackwell's at that time and also by Longman. And the consequent outcome of that was, in the one side, my evident series of books for Blackwell's, which are focused very much upon the primary area, a history of England really in manageable chunks for kids and teachers, but embodying the ideas behind, the thinking behind what we might call the new history and the new history teaching on the one hand. And on the other hand, we did a whole series of games and simulations for Longman, and produced a small book called Games and Simulations in History as the outcome of that. Mm. And after that, it was all very much developmental work, and I came down to Exeter 79 and ran the PGC History Programme.
So, was Repton a primary school?
Pardon?
Repton.
Repton is an outstanding jockstrap second division public school.
So how did you get your primary experience?
Never had any.
But it didn't prove a problem in writing for primary.
It's hilarious, isn't it?
What led you then to concentrate on history teaching in primary and middle school? Because you mainly concentrated on the sort of 7 to 13 age range.
Well, that might be your perception of it. I always worked in the secondary sector. Mm. And the books were very amenable and open to that age range. And the evidence series had massive sales inside the secondary sector. Because, in fact, it was a curriculum for the secondary sector, and then the next series on was the what we call the Blackwell History Project, ho ho ho, take an original idea and steal it, as in the school's council history project. And the idea there was to apply the ideas and thinking behind, let's call it the new history, we can come back to what that might mean, and to apply that to the GCSE phase. I should add, at this point in time, I was a member of the Associated Examining Board's GCSE / O-level / A-levels steering committee. In other words, 10 to a dozen of us ran the whole shooting match for the largest exam board at that time. And one of the points about writing and curriculum development is you need to have your networking feet under the table to know what's going on, i.e. if you're inside the curriculum development work inside the examination board, you're then in a position to actually create and develop highly marketable and highly commercially successful resources for schools. And that's what we did with the Blackwell History Project, very, very much so.
That was a publishing
later
venture,
yeah,
not
well,
a
publishing
curriculum development venture.
Well, it is a curriculum development venture because the two things go together. So, i.e. but it was a curriculum development in the sense it was reacting to changes in the examining system and then being introduced for GCSE, when we were going from CSE at O-level to GCSE, and everything was up in the air, how the hell do we do that? And being on the exam board, but all the discussions, debates, arguments, etc., what was going on, the structure and framing of the new curriculum, however that is defined, you had the knowledge, and the teachers need the resources, the books to work with the kids. And therefore you're in a position to write them, which is what I did.
That's in 1989?
In the 1980s, yeah, 88, 89, yeah.
Yes.
So that all comes out of working through, having the inside knowledge and the networking knowledge, etc., etc., in the same way that you picked up this this project because of David Cannadine's links with Lord Sainsbury. And that's not a problem. And this is how Nuffield works. And my Nuffield funding, which began in the 1980s, we'll come back to that later, it's all based upon networking. I support it. It's almost on the 18th century patronage system, whereby you actually go for good people. You obviously check the whole thing out. You've entered the proper stuff, as opposed to public competition, which produces far more duds than it provides live shells. And there's an interesting debate we had there about for the funding bodies. I did go to an evening thing in Exeter on this, where there was quite a bit of feathers flying around, in which one of the people in the Lord Drain was playing hell with the man who ran Leverhulme, who was saying, this is how we do it, you know, on the Nuffield patronage system. That's a nice background noise.
I know.
Yeah.
But we'll start again.
So, back to the curriculum development and history work, there was all the work which was the evidence series came off an interest in the new history. I talked about the simulation role, and then of course being involved in the Schools Council History Project, however tangentially, and then looking at how can you create something to get kids thinking, to get teachers to accept it. And the key here is to make something which is radical and different appear to be conservative and the same.
That's something that's interesting, isn't it? That schools history actually did appeal to so many people who were perhaps of quite conservative tendency, i.e. teachers,
yes,
at the chalk face. But why do you think that?
Well, you made it look the same. So when they started looking at what you were doing and asking the kids to do, they lit up a bit. Because what they had previously was, we mustn't do a parody of it, was what you call the transmission, the transformation stuff, the textbook, the Coots and Snell grow, the kids working in a particular pattern and so on. I'm not going to decry that. That approach to teaching history, which is still almost universal throughout a great deal of the world, has certain great strengths to it and has a clear and specific purpose. But what we try to do is to say, let us take that framework of knowledge which is in the mind of a teacher, and in terms of how they can work with children, make them or suggest that they do it differently, but to build a different pedagogy into it. So what you've got on the one side is, let's use this word, the substantive content side of the curriculum, look the same. Plato tomato, here we come. The whole entrenched curriculum which had developed. And in fact, as I believe you come across the International Journal of Historical Teaching, Learning, Research, and there's an interesting edition on this, with an interesting article in it, looking at the origins of the textbook in England. Your good lady friend will look at this. Where, in fact, the idea of the kind of knowledge that kids take out of schools in the old state system, there were no textbooks, there was no history on the curriculum, this is really before 1904, but what they did have were the readers, the stories of the great and good, and that was a wonderful insight, and that was how the historical knowledge was imparted. It was imparted through the tales and myths of these great biographies of these great figures, and this was a lovely idea.
So it's a sort of innovation by stealth.
And very much so, an innovation by stealth. And in fact, if you look at the post-1904 textbooks, and I got the Oxford and Cambridge one for 1904, after the 1902 Education Act, whatever it was, if you actually look at the content, and it's exactly the same content which we have now. It's extraordinary, the cultural continuity in terms of that which is taught. And it surfaced again brilliantly in this Rose curriculum, of its theme of humans, social, what was it I was reading on the train this morning, understanding, and suddenly it got on the politician's desk and it came back as historical, geographical and social understanding, back to the 1904 curriculum, which Robin Alexander has actually put that down in his latest report. Fascinating stuff, where you've got a continuity of curriculum which carries on. Men may come and men may go, but that historical continuity in the culture of the school community has a marvellous continuum. And therefore, to bring about change, you accept the mindset, the understanding, the orientation of your teachers, and you give it them something which looks very, very different. But when they begin to work, they say, yeah, now this is so much more interesting. This is a much more interesting way of doing that which I was doing anyway.
So it's method rather than content.
It's not method, it's pedagogy. You've got to be very clear about this. It's a pedagogy grounded in the knowledge and understanding of the nature of the discipline. There is a great danger of dismissing method, which has been done by the arrogant educationalists who couldn't teach their way out of a paper bag and know nothing about education whatsoever, but have controlled the education world. I can be quite ambivalent about them. I think they're a pain in the butt. They have great virtues and great strengths. But in relation to failing to understand that the strength of faculties of education is in those whom they demean and dismiss, which are the people who are actually doing the professional development of teachers at all phases, and they tend to dismiss that.
Do you think that teachers have adopted a new pedagogy without realising it, or it's filtered in through training?
Don't know. The evaluation, Shemlock's evaluation of schools councils suggested they didn't. And there was a real issue here, is they would go on teaching the same way. We just don't know. We don't have the evidence. And maybe you have it, I don't. I don't know. Nobody has sat down and looked at this as a... It's a really serious research question. But I don't... to my knowledge, and I may be completely ignorant, the lads in the Institute of Education might know about it, if there's any worthwhile research being done into this.
With your trainees that you had in Exeter and Plymouth, you were deliberately developing a pedagogy with them.
Yes, absolutely.
So is it feasible that that's happened across the country?
Who knows?
It's
feasible, yes. It's a hypothesis.
But you don't...
But we've got no evidence.
When you go into schools, do you see lessons that...
I go into schools very little now. I haven't done anything for 6 or 7 years.
But when you were going into schools, this
is a lovely one. It's a really good question. Because you don't see anything other than your trainees. How many teachers... How many times do you see other teachers teaching? And what I do say is all my curriculum development research, we talked interestingly about the primary in terms of that early stuff and never having taught it, but everything I wrote for kids on the secondary, I went and taught it with a teacher. And the interesting issue here is I worked closely in two teachers' classrooms over 20 years. I have not a single piece of evidence that the work I did with their children, with them looking, ever had any influence upon them whatsoever. And there was a theory about... the transfer of expertise from a trainer to a trainee, however that is defined, from an expert to a novice, which is called cognitive apprenticeship, which is actually a very powerful model. I've written extensively upon this. And that what it involves is basically somebody looks, you kick their ass, make them do it, and then they might learn. That's to give you the theory summed up very neatly and very succinctly.
Just want to take you back to the concept.
It's called demonstration modelling. Review, implementation. But you have to do it. You know, you learn something by doing it. It's a very simple idea. And by looking, you're not doing it. And you're not absorbing it. It's a different kind of knowledge in a way. And it's very much a hands-on, inactive training experience. And it's very, very well worked out. We ran on in service along these lines with John Fyfe. We'll carry on, yeah.
Going back to the content issue, would you not agree that Schools Council History Project introduced a new approach to content? And of course, there's been modern world courses that have.
Right. Well, of course, but that's what. But the whole thing came together. What I was doing, and lots of other people were doing, were taking a lot of the ideas from the Schools Council History Project, plus what had been fuelled by our own experience in terms of our own academic upbringing, which is not to be dismissed. And what I found very much with the Schools Council History Project was a congruence of ideas, that what Sylvester was doing was in some ways an intellectually valid and appealing rationalisation of that which I was almost doing intuitively, and John Fyfe was almost doing intuitively. And of course we would rationalise it, but there was something going on there which we could associate with very closely. And as I say to people in terms of John, is as John told me, and in fact at that seminar you were at, but Peter Lee corroborated it, John wrote the great handbook of the Schools Council History Project. I'm sure you've seen Dennis Shemmel, but Dennis produced this huge wadge of paper, and John told me he went away and effectively he wrote and produced the actual 30 to 60 book. And Peter Lee said the same thing. I don't know what Dennis says about it, what his view on it, take on it is, but I'm merely second-hand hearsay reporting what John told me. Which is interesting.
It is. That
fascinating.
That brings us on to John Fyfe. When did you first work with John Fyfe?
PGC tutor, I've got no memory today. One of the things I did with my PGC tutoring was to say that there's no point having an external exam, it's a complete waste of time. You should treat them as a consultant. So you go for the best people you can find who will then help you in terms of creating and developing your course. And that's how I met John. I got John to be my external, and that would have been in the late 80s. Can't remember the dates at all. And that's when we began working together. And then we went and we went to the Nuffield Foundation and got them to fund. Nuffield has funded me already extensively on something else, but that's by the way, and we'll come back to that. And we then picked up the primary history project and the A-level project.
So how did the primary
A-level project and the primary project, that's the right way around it went.
Yes.
Well, easy, because we were so fed up with the wretched national curriculum that we felt, that let's try and get something else going on primary and A-level history.
And what was the chief thing that you were trying to do?
Well, introduce a methodology of getting kids doing, let's take the doing history thing. And what we'd understood of the nature of historical learning and the ways in which it could affect young people, and then translate that into the curriculum. And so what we did is, we both in the primary and secondary, we started with this basic premise that we wanted kids to be doing history in terms of processes, protocols, skills, all the rest of the stuff. And that has been an underlying conception ever since. And Jack Hexter's The History Prime, if you said, do we have a textbook for that, or a single book? And really, the real driver was our own experience as historians. And I can talk about John on that in a minute. It is that there is a book by Jack Hexter called The History Prime. It's a wonderful book, which nobody seems to know about. It's a major book on the theory and practice, on the theory and practice of history as an academic discipline. And we used that and referred to it. And an idea about where the driving force coming out of history as an academic discipline came from is, with its social overtones, was John's own story of how his epiphany, his moment of conversion, was John at Cambridge, enjoyed life, and to the extent that his tutor, John told me these stories, his tutor wrote to every education department in the country and said, this man is unfit to teach, do not take him. Which I think is an interesting development. And despite that, somebody took the plunge, and John trained. He didn't get a job in academia, or he turned it down, I'm never quite clear which. And he ended up as being a history teacher who fulfilled the worst fears of his tutor at Cambridge. And he was so bad that he had to keep the kids in detention. And who are we to mock anybody else of our own earlier, even later failings in discipline haunting us. And John was doing his PhD upon the recusants of the Tudor period. And in order to pass the time of his very large detention class, he would bring along his recusancy records, his cards, and he'd get the kids to help him work on this stuff for his PhD. And that was all okay, until suddenly a queue formed outside the detention room of kids wanting to join Mr. Fine's club. That was it. Getting kids engaged with resources, getting them thinking, getting them discussing, debating, enjoying, etc. And then John, away went John and became the great man we all know him to be. But it's fascinating that there was suddenly a this accidental, rather like the person that was terrified of his wife who discovered how to make rubber out of the stuff which came out of rubber trees. He was experimenting. His wife accused him of a wastrel into trying to make this stuff into rubber. His wife came home and supper was cooking, and he didn't know what dare to tell you, still working on developing rubber, and he shoved the substance into the oven, and when it came out baked hard, he said, ah. That's apocryphal. But anyway, John had his conversion, and there you see is an interesting issue of the relationship between academic history and teaching. In my case, as I told you, it was about the modelling and seeing something and doing the creative connection between the two. The creativity is making connection. Often, the more interesting the creativity, the more unnatural and unexpected are those connections, which once you've made them seem totally obvious.
That suggests a connection just between practically looking at sources and enjoying history.
Absolutely right.
But John finds his ideas go beyond that.
Yeah, but that's where it started. That was the first. That's when it all started, and in terms of John and the intellectual origins of what was going on, I can help a little bit, but please, please, don't quote me. because I mean it was incidental conversation. A great influence was Dorothy Heathcote and drama, and the great influence there was a man who I think was an absolute genius, a man called Ray Verrier. You come across Fiennes and Verrier, you know. Yeah. Now Ray is still alive. He's probably become a monk. He was in the most diffident, shy, self-effacing man. But if you read the stuff he wrote, he was something special. He worked at Bishop Otter when John went to Bishop Otter, and Ray came back and told John about Dorothy Heathcote, and Ray started doing all the drama stuff. So the driving influence there was Ray. Where the influence on storytelling came in, I have no idea. It could have been the same source, but certainly on drama, that was Dorothy Heathcote, where he developed his ability to tell stories. Well, he used to do it at school, and in order to, because he was always in detention, and to tell stories to teachers, to amuse the teachers, which, and he told some wonderful stories about his school days in that context. But when you put the whole thing together, by he'd obviously gone into Bishop Otter, and he'd then become acquainted with Roy Wake, and in particular, Roy Wake picked him up, and I'm just doing this off the top of my head, so I don't know. And that very, very great man, John Slater, who picked John up. John Slater was the... I came along when John Slater was a staff inspector of history, and he was a totally benign and positive influence, and a very, very great influence. And his pamphlet, History in the Primary and Secondary Years, was extremely important, extremely seminal. Have you seen John Slater?
He's in Australia.
Yeah, well.
So I haven't been out there. I've got an email.
What a good idea. he was really very, very
good. I had the book when I trained, yeah. The History of Primary and Secondary Years.
Hipsy, yeah.
And as well as your own book. So I've,
Yeah, but he was very important. Mm. And he was behind the curtain importance. And I don't know the politics of the school's council and all the rest of it, John was very influential in there. And of course, the great disaster was when David Sylvester failed to become the staff inspector following him, as you probably know that story, where he got up the nose of whoever. And that champagne bottles, corks, Hennessy became the HMI for history, and the man who wrote the National Curriculum for History. I'm too old to be unkind about people, but I don't know if you're going to talk to Hennessy. Hennessy wrote the National Curriculum. Do you know that?
Well, he's credited with having a lot of influence.
Well, more than that, he actually sat down and did a lot of the writing, because Robert Guyver was a very close friend of mine, and Guyver told me all about what was going on at the time.
Well, I'm going to talk to Mr. Guyver. So
yeah, Robert's great fun, but he was very powerfully and very influential. Much more so than he should have been. I mean, he was not the neutral observer during that writing about National Curriculum. And Robert talked about him actually being on the typewriter and doing things or whatever at that time. And he was... And we'll leave it at that. I mean, Robert will tell you exactly what went on.
But John Fiennes wasn't completely negative about the National Curriculum, was he?
Yes.
Well, I have an article here from Primary History, which actually, from 1994, which is about the Deering Review. But he's actually crediting National Curriculum History with its many defects has in fact had a remarkably good effect on the education of young children.
Oh, well, I said that's absolutely fine. That's no problem about that, because that's not an issue. The issue is that the first time some history went into the primary curriculum, as supposed to be virtually that nothing there at all of any value or interest. I mean, the Peter Knight work, poor Peter died. That ESRC project showed actually just how very skimpy and a very, very limited history as a subject in primary schools was before 1988-89. This was a revolution and very, very important, so it had a phenomenal impact. But in terms of the national curriculum itself, it was just a complete nonsense. John and I felt very strongly about that, and anybody who looks at it objectively said it was a scheme invented by idiots, implemented by morons, and you know, it's like that one of, oh, God, you just look at it and you say, what were they playing at? But when you look at it, they did actually have the skills and processes and the substantive element side by side. So that was very, very good. But the real impact on primary schools is they put it on the primary curriculum. That was where the great impact came on it. And just talking very loosely, in the southwest of England, we only knew of two examples of good primary history practice, the whole southwest of England.
Before the national curriculum?
Yeah.
And how many did you know about afterwards?
Well, it was a very, very large increase, a very large number. I can't put a number on it, but it was being put in and implemented and so on. I mean, And when you look at all the stuff we did on our chess courses and so on, there was a major movement, a major change, which took place in late. And the national curriculum was a catalyst for that. And they had this Association of Primary History Teachers, which then merged the Historic Association. And let's face it, things have been looking up a bit. We've now got circulation has gone up about 100 or 50 or something. Primary history, we've got 700 going out. So something's happening, and I'm doing my very best, particularly in the context of the Rose Review, to have a real whacker slamming it back into schools. Because, as I said, the politicians, having this atavistic curriculum, looking back to the ancestors, have actually done it again. Historical, geographical, and social understanding. Whoopee! Back to 1904. Great. Great, the Historical Association. And they just swept away any idea of change and development over the last 30 years. Just put it into the shredder.
Well, does that mean that teachers themselves have changed the way they teach?
I think the argument about how they teach, there's a congruence between Plowden and the teaching, the Piagetian-based teaching which underlay the Plowden Report, and good history teaching. And that is what Peter Knight said in his research into what they looked at the effective teaching of history in the late 70s, early 80s, from memory. And that's what you can pick up. So there is no real problem. But then you have to give the teachers the critical knowledge and understanding of the nature of the discipline, and then the pedagogy related to it, in order for them to implement it and make the thing that much more intellectual. Well, intellectually, that much more, not viable, that much more, coherent, have substantive basis, instead of just being mimicry in some shape or form.
So are you saying that the politicians have been the friends of history in the primary sector and not in the secondary?
I wouldn't say anything about the secondary sector, but in the primary sector, I say that they were the friends in the national curriculum coming in, that they actually put on the curriculum for primary. Mm. In terms of secondary, I've got nothing to say about it, really. There's no comment at this point in time. Thank you. Mm. Well, it's a national curriculum subject. Mm. But what you will have picked up is this whole issue about the politicians harking back to the Plato to NATO heroes, heroines, etc., etc.
So would you say that the content doesn't matter?
I'm saying the opposite, because that's why I wasn't going to comment on it. I think there is a view inside the history education community in some peculiar way that content doesn't matter, or that the content, which is our island story, which I must get hold of, because I'm going to put it into my next edition of Primary History, and that if you look at Hodkinson's work on chronology, it doesn't really look at the question of is it about dates, or is it about political education? When you actually look at what those dates and the framework, the narrative framework, it's a question of mythology, it's a question of identity, it's a question of trying to get the young people of the country in some sense locked into the key factors or features of how the country evolved and developed, so that they can get a very clear sense of where their citizenship comes from. And that's what that Plato to NATO curriculum is about. It's very contentious, particularly in a multi-ethnic, multicultural society, to put it mildly.
So what would your preferred alternative be?
Oh, I call it a contemporary history curriculum, but that's another story. Real point one, I think.
Yeah. I'd really like to explore that, though. I mean, if it's important, how do you make the decision about who decide? You know,
these are second-order issues. And by the second order and third order issue of actually arguing and debating and who takes and away you go, obscures the first order issue, is become what is the kind of knowledge and understanding of their past that we want young citizens in a plural democracy to have when they leave school and retain in some significant way through their adult, into and through their adult lives.
And would you say that debate has not been had?
I'd say it's been had. The politicians think they have won it. The history educators think they pulled the chain on it and flushed it down the whatever. And the question is where are we on this one?
Where are we at the moment?
I don't know. The argument of that one, we do know where we are. Ask Peter Lee about that Children's Knowledge of History project they ran a couple of years ago. Do you know about that one?
The Chatter one?
No, they had one after that. And
they've published anything from it, as far as I can see.
Well, you need to talk to them about it, because they actually did a survey of what kind of historical knowledge kids have at school and take from school. That was their last major research project. His and Ross's latest research project. I don't know what it was called. They published a bit on it, And basically what they came up with is that the kids know absolutely sod all about sod all. There's not very much of a surprise, really, is it? But there is research into it, about what kind of knowledge are these children taking away from school in the context of the substantive dimension of it, as opposed to the syntactic skills procedure side of it.
And does it matter if they haven't any concrete knowledge to take away from it?
It depends what concrete knowledge is, or whatever it is, or if they've absorbed the skills knowledge processes side of it, maybe you're right. But there are issues here, and I wrote an editorial in Primary History on this, is how do we avoid 7-7? How do we avoid young English citizens and blowing up the underground? That's the political dimension to that. And that's why I said you've got to look at this idea of some frame. I don't like these ideas of frameworks. John thought they were absolute nonsense. I'm sure he was right. But what kind of view of their own country within that historical dimension do the young have, which they take into adult life? And the problem about the Ireland story and the politicians is it's rural Britannia, etc., 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 you know, as in the context of history education. Parodied, as I was told, by Ralph Samuel. No, I've been talking rubbish. Ralph Samuel, that very, very great man, wonderful, wonderful man, pointed out that maybe apocryphal again, 1066, and all that is a serious political statement about the kind of history which led to the slaughter of the First World War. Isn't it an interesting point? So this is an issue and a debate which I think does need looking at with sensitivity, and I'm not going to say there's a consensus of opinion around what kind of facts kids should be taken away, or knowledge to understand kids should be taken away from school, but it is not to be poo-pooed because it's a very difficult and contentious issue, which is where we were coming to, and that is a problem. And I agree with that.
I wanted to ask
anyway, I'm being radical on that one.
That's okay. I wanted to ask you about the school's history project, which we've referred to already.
Yeah.
You referred to it as having three parts: David Sylvester's, the Shemmelt concepts, and then Colin Shepherd's good works, as you describe them.
What I could mean.
So, could you just elaborate on what you mean by those three phases?
I think what we've got to say here is I can only talk about the first two, and I can talk about all three, but very quickly. I mean, Sylvester, to me, and I hope this ties in with your interview room, was he had an intellectual coherence, understanding. I went to the talk which he was giving in 1977 about it. What he was doing, very, very interesting. And he was very clearly of an understanding, who took the Collingwood model, I hope, again, do let me know if I'm wrong, about what is history. He looked at the idea of history. He actually took a lot of the things he then tried to translate into pedagogy off that book. And said this is an alternative to Plato to NATO transmission model. And this was built around the idea of constructivism, the use of evidence, the idea of representation of understanding from the perspective of the child as historian, for want of a better term. And then Shemmelt did this evaluation. And so that was phase one with David and his project team, etc., and he produces the What is History packs and so on. He then moved into creating and developing the exam course by the end of 3 years, understandably, etc. And the history of medicine course, that's what he knew about, etc., etc. So, and the ways in which different forms of knowledge, study in depth, outline, whatever you look at, local history came into that. We won't worry too much about that, we'll spend all day talking about those. But then Shemmelt produced this evaluation, and something happened very peculiarly, because we suddenly got this idea of history is about teaching for concepts. And this is all being picked up by Peter Lee and their good, what they did in the context of the Institute. And this then became Dave Shemmelt is the school's council history project. And I just sit there and say, this is bonkers. The evaluator is the guy who created it. Now, the other could be, is the evaluator and interpretation of the evaluation by Lee in particular with Dennis, and they're working together in terms of the Institute of Education paradigm, may well have led to a reconceptualization of what the School's Council History Project was, but it ain't nothing to do with what the original thing was and the one which I identified with. And then you move on to the Colin Shepherd period, which has effectively become basically not just Colin Shepherd, but my brain's gone to putty. Chris, or whatever his name,
Chris Colvin.
Chris Colvin, very, very philosophical, very sane.
So would you say that Sylvester was about engaging children and developing their understanding, whereas Shemalt is about thinking skills?
Well, I'm sure, I think the first point of your statement is probably quite right. And Sylvester's is about the thinking of the paradigm of how historians operate and work within the context of the world of a child. Mm. So the idea that it's not thinking skills is a nonsense, because it's thinking skills, it's processes, it's concepts, it's the protocols, and that's one thing I come on to, is the protocols are related in terms of history in different forms, like biography and local history, narrative, or whatever. And so I thought Sylvester was very much the whole thing's about thinking, but within the contextualised, within grounded in the academic discipline and the different forms which that academic discipline can take in terms of what kind of history we're getting the kids to do. Whereas to me, I'm not very clear about where the Shemalt stuff came from, but their argument and councillors carry this on is, oh, but these second order concepts, and therefore we build our programmes of education around these second order concepts, which is completely bonkers. I mean, to put it simply, the Sylvester approach is holistic. The whole thing is a holistic process, whereas the Shemalt Lee approach appears to be, and certainly the council one, is to break it down, not to atomise it, because they're far not, into these big chunks like causation and chronology, these second order concepts and interpretations and so on. And so you've got these second order concepts, which are driving the whole thing forward, which is putting the cart before the horse, which is actually getting terribly confused in the real sense about what is the nature of the discipline.
Thank you. Makes it much clearer.
That's my view.
I was going to ask you what you thought had been the overall effect of SHP on history teaching.
I think the whole overall effect, very oddly, is to say, in terms of moving on from a paradigm which is grounded in the Our Island story and that wonderful man, Unstead, and how he presented it, which was to freshen up, cheer it up, and tell the stories and make them really interesting, exciting, and fun for kids, which is what he did brilliantly. And of course, I mustn't do this one, but all that tends to get thrown into the dustbin without recognising its great qualities and virtues. But it moved that on to a form in which is congruent with the idea of education, getting kids to think, defending your discipline in the context of being attacked from various sides. What is the relevance of it? What are you doing? And interestingly, when I ran things in Exeter on a humanities programme, and I was running it with one of our religious studies people, and he came along to my sessions with undergraduates. I never teach undergraduates, I don't stand up and do that very little. Is making them function in terms of solving historical problems and the procedures of questioning, investigation sources, making them a discussion and debate, and obviously with a large substantive element in what they're reading, both, well, let's call it, for want of a better term, the secondary sources and the first hand sources, whatever. And based upon a clear statement of what the discipline is about, he sort of said, John, really, it's very interesting seeing you working here, because compared to religious education, you actually have an underlying philosophy of your discipline, which has never occurred to me before. It just struck me as pretty obvious of what we were doing then. And of course, the great problem of doing that in the university sector with these very nice young ladies, often very bright, it had sod all to do with the kind of history they'd had at school, frankly. Which is again the cultures enshrined in the examination system, which reflect the successful models of teaching of those at that point dominated, which was a transmission transformation model. I'm not decrying the qualities of that either, don't get me wrong, it has great strengths in a certain way, certain for mental training of a certain kind. I'm not going to be knocking.
I want to come onto your own particular interests, particularly starting with simulation. That was an early interest.
We've done
as
that,
you mentioned.
Yeah.
So,
made a lot of sense.
Do you think that simulation really brings the learning of history alive more to younger children, or that it's applicable to
all late stages and it's all phases of life? And as a training method, it is used universally across all disciplines and all areas of training. It's the basic tool of training people to do any professional job, as you engage them in some form of simulation work, war games, call it what you like.
How did you come to connect simulations to history teaching?
Well, I told you earlier, it was to do with the East India Company, Kirti Chowdhury, modelling, etc., Bex Walford historical games, and then seeing how you can actually produce models of historical situations, and that was what the Longman book was about.
Right.
And it's continued from then on. And so that's been an underlying feature of our work.
And then you've developed your work in ICT. Did that spring out of simulations?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that came very interestingly, and nobody really knows this, 1982 January, and a man called, my brain is gone, completely gone, turned up from Imperial College London, David Ennals, and Richard Ennals, David's his father, the politician, Richard Ennals, and he had been very interested in game simulation, and he had been employed by Imperial College, a man called Kowalski, the great intellectual father of logic programming in this country, which was going to be the thing which swept computing into the 21st century. And Kowalski had been to his children's school in Wimbledon Middle School, and had been horrified at the BBC, at the kind of inane computing which was then being developed in the early 1980s on a language called BASIC. He tried to get the school to teach the kids what was called prologue programming in logic, failed, and he employed Ennals to do it. Programming logic, logic programming, if you don't know, any knowledge of this? No? Why should you have any? It's what it says. You get a computer language which is based upon predicate logic, and the damn machine thinks logically. You put rules in, you put data in relating to those rules, and the machine goes chunk, 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 and come out with a set of logical statements and logical conclusions. In other words, it's actually in a recognisably human way that machine is thinking. And I saw that in January 1982 and thought, this is fantastic, because it tied into the whole question of modelling in terms of gaming and simulation, rules, structures, etc. And then for the next 8 or 9 years, I spent all my time doing logic programming and then what was known as knowledge-based systems, expert systems, with people from Imperial College. And I found it very interesting.
Did you produce commercial simulations for?
No, we didn't do anything commercial, but we did. But it was all very effective, and I'm sure the thinking behind it. And I ran something called PEG, which is called PEG, Prologue Something Group, and I ran about 9 or 11 international conferences. It was
for teachers to.
No, these were academics mainly across the world. So and ran the last one in St. Petersburg in 2003.
So these weren't simulations to be used in schools then?
Yeah, they were. That's how we developed it. But the whole idea of logic programming, the idea of knowledge-based systems, and the way in which you get things to think and represent understanding, and you get kids to program in using logical language to do, and their knowledge and understanding develop from processing information in order to get it function as a computer program. And you got them to do it in English because you produce what we call shells, where you put the information in, and we had shells for simulation, we had shells for investigations, for dealing with declarative databases.
So this was an international project?
It was a project which was funded by Nuffield, which had huge international ramifications, which we ran these project programs, etc., and very successful internationally.
And were they based on...
Prologue Education Group, that's what it
was. Sorry.
Peg. Yep.
Were they based on children completing simulations in tandem in different international locations?
Oh, no, about my work was everybody who worked independently. Right. These were people who came together. It represented a way of thinking about the use of computers, not only in education, widely. And the educational side, it was we worked with some of the very leading computer scientists in this country, like people like Ben de Boulay at Sussex. And it was another side of my life which I don't talk about really, because I've enjoyed doing it. And it was only tangentially related to history education, history of my brain. But it came out of the history of education, and it came through Ennals, who was a history teacher, having been employed by Kowalski.
And did what came out of it that was actually long term?
Did it sod all.
Nothing. You've read about simulations quite a bit, haven't you, though? The use of simulation.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's influence affecting, but in terms of information and computing and ICT, in a way, the thinking behind what we were trying to do was to use this as a powerful tool for thinking in a way which mapped onto the discipline, which mapped onto the substantive knowledge. Well, that is absolutely appropriate till right up until now. And I don't want to go into this one into because things have moved on. But it really, it was a very, very powerful set of ideas. And of course, all the history education work was going on at the same time. I did that for a very, very long time. And I'm sure we were right. I mean, don't spend all that time spending a huge amount of time and energy doing something if you think it's wrong. And I'm quite happy to scrap stuff and say it's rubbish.
Mm. But in terms of teaching in the classroom, obviously simulation was used from text originally, and then computer simulations came in, and then it seems to have gone off the agenda.
It has indeed, because those computer simulations were, and the simple answer is, why can't you do it with pencil and paper? I mean, that's, and we had a huge war with Francis Blow and all these people, because, and also with the Michael Education Programme, the whole, there was a completely different philosophy behind the Logic Programme, which was to get the kids to write the computer programs, and through that to develop an extended understanding of whatever they were looking at. You get them to write their own computer simulations upon whatever topic of simulation they were using on, whether it was a voyage of discovery, whether it was Francis Drake, whether it was the Battle of Jutland, or whatever. And you then get them to do investigative databases. And one we produced was called Green Dye, which was a murder, classic murder mystery. We've done a lot of these, done the Princess of Towers in as well. And the classic one, the first one we did, was called Green Dye, and it was John Doe's Collingwood Mystery. And it is actually a marvellous computer simulation. We still use it, and it's online and all the rest of it. But it never took off, or never got widely adopted. Why not? Oh, probably not very good at the dissemination side, I suppose, frankly. And it was not, it did not map on to the conventional wisdom I must be very careful here. In information technology and education, split into two groups. There were those who had been working away, squirreling away on their BBC acorns at home, and teachers had been working in their attics, okay? And then there was the computer scientist world. I've got to be very careful, it's very crude. And the hackers, the enthusiasts, took over educational computing in this country. And they just got it completely wrong. And it's been a complete disaster in reality, if you look at it. Hopeless. Total waste of money. In a real sense, like the National Grid for Learning was a classic example of it. It's £1 billion project, the same as the Dome. Not known about. Impact 2 evaluation study showed it was a complete and utter waste of money. And that was typical. And I don't want to get into this conversation, but the computer science stuff, the work we were doing, conceptually, I'm absolutely convinced was right, where these were powerful tools for supporting thinking and tools through which thinking could be developed and extended for children.
Do you think that there has been progress made in recent times? Because a lot of the surveys I'm getting back show that history teachers are using technology a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely fine. The interactive blackboard stuff is very powerful, very important. Although the research shows they're using it exactly the same way as they used to use the blackboard.
They do get children to do documentaries, use...
Yeah, that's fine. That's all multimodality. The idea that all my work is said is, why on earth do you and this did a lot of work on literacy as well, is genre is the key thing. I'm a great fan of the thinking behind the National Literacy Strategy, which is called Functional Literacy, which is genre theory, and yeah, absolutely marvellous. Why, and actually my ideas for CPD on this is why on earth should teachers represent their knowledge and understanding in terms of what they're doing in schools in an appropriate genre, instead of writing these 4,000 word essays for academic educators just to show the academic educators how clever they are? It's complete nonsense.
But you call that just a shift in mode of communication?
That's multimodality and mode of communication. Very, an extremely powerful shift. And I'm the whole idea of using blogs and interactivity and all of it, totally in favour of all that stuff, no problem with that whatsoever. But we were talking about the actual nature of the resources which were produced in the context of the computing specialists in the 80s and 90s for history education. History education is just a minor leaf on the whole tree of that whole movement. And where is it all now? Basically a complete waste of time and money.
So do you think that there's hope for the use of computers in the future?
Well, massively. And I go back to Andrew Hunt, who ran Nuffield Science, the Nuffield curriculum. And Andrew said very quietly one day, I thought, lovely bloke, very, very nice, very powerful. Very powerful in his thinking. He said, look, John, he said, the only educational use of ICT computing in schools is that which has been commercially successful. Mm. And that is a really powerful argument. Very powerful way of looking at it. You know, take the whole power of the huge amount of incredibly successful commercial software, apply that within the context of the schools, and then the thing takes off, like the interactive blackboards, like the use of the technology to produce documentaries, the idea of interaction in terms of through webcams and all the rest of it, and shared ideas and conferences, and that's all commercial software. The actual stuff which has been developed by educators for educational purposes you've got to look at it with very, very grave doubts and very grave concern. And I went to the Bechter. I was invited to the Bechter annual giving of awards stuff about 2 years ago by Tribal. And you just sat there. They gave these awards, this sort of self-congratulatory group of commercial software writers. And you just looked at it and thought, you know, Mickey Mouse rules again. And they were producing stuff and clapping each other using all the gizmos. You said, well, wait a minute. That kind of basic thinking was done way back in the 80s and 90s. I mean, like another idea of high-level, high-quality thinking from the world of computing was like Logo, the whole Logo movement in mathematics. And they were doing Logo programs with the Turk. And you go along to Beck and a lot of the stuff, they say, oh, this is primitive compared to the... Never mind, but that was all the commercial world. But I can whistle on a bit on that. We're not doing too well on our time too long.
We're okay. I wanted to ask you about the gifted and talented, which you told me had been a major interest in your career.
We've trundled our way down here, haven't we? Yeah. It's all very difficult to talk about the gifted and talented thing. The National Academy for Gifted and Talented Youth, right, let's go back. This is worth knowing. Let's go back to basics. The assisted places scheme by the Tories until 1997 in effect produced a valve for talented kids in the comprehensive system to have what was allegedly an academic education. These are crude, brutal, simplistic and probably wrong statements. The Labour Party in 1997 introduced an abolition of the assisted places scheme, which meant that valve for the old, what you might call the old grammar school kids from working class background, that valve was then turned off. Whether that valve was ever open, that's why I say it might be criticism implicit, but that it would be a perception. And we're not prepared to discuss that here because I don't know. The government has a most interesting minister who's now transferred, a man called Lord Adonis. Do you know about all this stuff?
Oh, yes.
Now, Lord Adonis, and do put it into Google. I'm going to tease you. Put him into Google. Get his biography from Wikipedia.
I've read it.
But what an amazing background.
Yes.
Absolutely right. Now, and he, in fact, became Tony Blair's principal private advisor in 10 Downing Street. Talk about a minister behind the curtain or an eminent screen. He was that. By Tony Blair's, I could lose my brain's power, by his third ministry, he had in effect become an incredibly powerful and influential figure inside 10 Downing Street. And one of the arguments put forward of why Tony Blair's final ministry in many ways was more successful was because of Adonis's influence. But an interest which Adonis developed in the late 1990s was gifted and talented education. And he promoted and pushed it on all through 10 years until he got up the nose of Ed Ball, who moved him on. And now Gibson Tans is disintegrated. And in 2001, again Shaggy Dog stuff, I, with two or three other people, wrote the bid for Exeter University for the National Academy for Gibson Tans Youth. And my role is this ability to be extremely off-the-wall creative thinking. And I simply said to the Vice-Chancellor, you're mad, which he took as a compliment. The idea that we are a highly prestigious academic university, we've mapped along Imperial College, Durham, Oxford, Cambridge, Warwick, you know, we're clearly in that class. So flick it over. We'll go for the polyversities. Yeah. So we'll write a bid based upon a consortium of the big polytechnics to compete against the elitists. Get it? Look at it. Turn our weakness into a strength. And the man who drove that idea forward was a man called David Burgess, a great maths guru, major national international figure. And David, myself, and to a certain extent a man called David Melville, David had nothing to do with it, really. And the VC himself, the VC went into overdrive on this, sort of about clubman networking, Lord Sainsbury and all that, and David Canada. So Geoffrey Holland was in there. He'd been a permanent civil servant in England. Yeah. He was great. And so we had a whale of a time, and we won the bid for NAGTI. But Tony had promised to his mate who was VC of Warwick. So we would run him up. And as a consequence of that, David Reynolds is very, very, very well connected, we were offered one of the summer schools. And I ended up directing the summer school for Exeter. And here I am. And then I wrote the bid for Southwest University as a partnership of Exeter, Bath and Plymouth University, at which point I'd been culled out of Exeter, being made redundant, etc. Too old, too expensive, too useless. And I took the bid to Plymouth, which upset Exeter no end, but never mind, that's history. And I've been massively working ever since in gifted and talented education, but also in that context, applying the ideas in history education. I run summer schools and masterclass, which I deliver as through history, and so that's been that influence. And if you look at my primary history stuff, you'll see quite a bit in there about the cognitive acceleration in history education. Which I believe in very strongly. I think it's the best of all the, what you might call the teaching theories about how do we actually get teaching to operate effectively with kids are called CASHE, C-A-C-H-E. Cognitive acceleration in science education was based upon, which is SHARE and AD. And that has been a major influence. And in fact, I'm going to put a bit in it on the next primary history, which is Ho, 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 Planning for Historical, Geographical and Social Understanding, which is in the bag. Which is again on this whole business where we started earlier. How do you do things? You go with the flow, you go with what the teachers know and understand, and therefore they're faced with this challenge. So we will produce a highly simple, practical set of ideas of how they can actually implement a new thematic curriculum in the context of historical, geographical, and social understanding, which is one of the six new things, and take it from there.
I mean, adapting the old curriculum to the new.
Well, in fact, going back to 1988.
I think fine.
Well, I'll set it down as email me and I'll set it down as an attachment.
Thank you.
Because what she's doing there is she's picking up Alan Bly's work, which we both bought, where there was a 3-year project on dealing with the concept historical is. And look at what it says.
Yeah.
Look at the title. Wasn't there no look at the subtitle? Look what it says. In history. And what's a new national curriculum?
Yes, history, geography, and social
Historic.
Studies.
Smile. Yes. But then what you've got here, and this is where we're talking about, this is quite a useful thing to end on, or not, but this is quite interesting because what we have is this is really up to date, 2010, isn't it? 9, 8, 7. What? You must be joking. 1976.
I suppose it's true what teachers say. All the best ideas come round and round.
Yeah,
again.
But the sharp point on that is this was a proper academic project.
It was funded by
Schools Council. One of the range of those. And this is the one which has stuck with us. It's stuck in all our minds, and suddenly we've blown the dust off it. Mm. And we've just tried to say, well, what are the kind of philosophical underpinnings to how you actually deal with this? And I was reading it this morning. I wondered, you know, I said, well, do it on the train. I'll pass a little Mickey Mouse book to go, because that actually is the one. And it's still empty. Here we are. I'll be there.
I'll stop the tape if that's okay. Move beyond the interview.
Well, no, not because this is right. This
yeah.
In fact is really important for the interview, and we can switch it back on when I find it. You turn it on again. In discussing the place of concept, this is Alan Blythe, 1976, Place, Time and Society, an introduction to their big book, Curriculum Planning in History, Geography and Social Science. In discussing the place of concept in children's learning about place, time and society, the project team came to see that there might be particular advantages in looking at their subject area to see where some common elements could be found which were important to history, geography and the social sciences. These common elements could be described as key concepts. There are four substantive key concepts mainly concerned with elements and processes in society: communication, power, values and beliefs, conflict and consensus. And three methodological, what we would call second order concepts, mainly concerned with ways of analysing society: similarity, difference, continuity, change, causes and consequences. And of course in history we put evidence and chronology in as well. And so the whole project was built around these ideas. Subjects can be looked at in more than one way. First, they are what is found on the timetable of traditional secondary schools. These can be called school subjects, etc. Secondly, behind these school subjects, there are subjects as fields of scholarship and research. So history as a school subject is a body of information and a set of skills and ways of thinking which is affected more or less by what is going on in history as a research and academic discipline. The same is true in a slightly different way of geography. So how modern are we? This means that they are taught they should be drawn upon in a balanced way in the actual programme that is followed in the middle years. And this is the concept, I'll come back on this, the idea of critical thinking. The project emphasises critical thinking, and subjects as tools, something to be drawn upon in the relation to the development of these conceptual understanding, both substantive and syntactic. And then they go on talking about it. This is 1976. This is in many ways radically new now as well, because in 1988-89 the government Stalinized the curriculum, they nationalized the curriculum and they destroyed it by putting in putting into the curriculum the atavistic knowledge and understanding of what education was about through the lens and through the memories of highly intelligent politicians and their advisors who were harking back to the golden age of their prep schools. Which time to shut up.
Thank you very much, John.